Next on the Capital Connection, a conversation with Jesse McKinley, the amazing Albany bureau chief of the New York Times. We'll talk about anything you ever wanted to know about New York state government. So join us for a conversation with Jesse McKinley of the New York Times next on the Capital Connection.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Jesse McKinley, the Albany bureau chief for the New York Times. Welcome back, Jesse, and may I say, the best we've ever had.
Oh, thank you so much, Alan.
So there are a lot of things to talk about. The one thing in New York State that seems to be interesting is the all-out, well, maybe civil war between the progressives and the institutionalists. What do you think?
Well, I think that Tiffany Caban race in Queens is like the most recent evidence of that. And I think it is, it's a real thing. I mean, you know, her win in Queens, if it holds up, shows you that kind of grassroots, progressive, fiery energy can really galvanize a race, particularly in a low turnout primary like that.
For district attorney, yeah.
And it's, you know, but it's not insubstantial. You know, this is the second time that Andrew Cuomo, the governor, has bet on the wrong horse in Queens. And that is, of course, his home county. It's his home territory, and in both the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez race and in the Tiffany Caban race, he misjudged exactly how much energy there is in that progressive wing of the party, and it won those races. And you know, AOC endorsed Caban. She lined up other people behind her, and it is an issue inside the Democratic Party, I think, because the establishment is not winning those sorts of races at all.
So is AOC the name of the game?
I think to a large extent for people that are new to politics, to people that are fired up by the Trump presidency, for people that want to really get engaged, absolutely. I mean, her endorsement means the world to them. It really gets people on the street. It gets people knocking on doors. It gets people, like, leafleting. It gets people making phone calls. And that sort of kind of grassroots action is what wins races, particularly in Democratic primaries.
I know this is a bad question to ask a reporter as opposed to an editorialist, but is this a good thing or a bad thing?
I'm not going to answer that.
I mean, gotcha.
I think you could generally say for democracy, it's good for people to get involved. You know, you want people to vote. You want people to be engaged. You want people to read the news. You want people to be informed. Whether, you know, one person wins or not, I don't care. But I do think it's a good thing that people do pay attention to the political process. And I spend a lot of my time trying to make people do that.
That's right. You do. And you do it wonderfully. So are you in a spot where you can see a serious change in the politics of New York State? After all, Andrew Cuomo won his election mightily, his primary election, his general election mightily. He collected all kinds of money. And yet it does seem that this is that this AOC thing, the progressive thing, is creeping up on him and everybody else.
Well, as you pointed out, he just got reelected. I don't think he's worried about his electoral prospects at any time soon. And you know, I've had this discussion with other reporters and other pundits. You know, this is a deeply blue state. You know, Andrew Cuomo, if he wants to run for a fourth term, would probably win a fourth term because, you know, there's no credible primary challenger that I can see at this point, but, you know, we're 3 years out. And also the votes are there in terms of, you know, Democrats outnumber Republicans here more than 2-1. But, you know, largely writ, like, you do see a change in Albany in terms of, you know, the election in November added a lot of new members to the Senate in particular. And I think those members made their voices heard. And I think that the legislative agenda that was passed, you know, last week really reflected their interests. It reflected their kind of progressive idealism. I think the governor would want to kind of lay claim to that. But I think really at the end of the day, it was legislature that was driving the bus. So
now the Democrats have taken the Senate and all kinds of progressive legislation, as you indicate, has passed. And maybe you can go over some of that with us. But do you think that the Democrats risk overplaying their progressive hand?
Well, I think particularly in moderate districts in Long Island, that is the concern. You know, for years and years and years, those were Republican held seats. And the Democrats were able to flip them. But by and large, those are kind of, you know, fiscally conservative, socially moderate, you know, districts. And I think the Democrats are worried. And I think even with an issue like, you know, the driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants, that was an issue that the Democrats were very, very worried about taking a vote on. And that entire block of those six Long Island Democrats completely bolted on that issue. So, yeah, there will be discussions going forward as to whether or not the political, you know, because next year will be an election year, right? So 2020, all those senators will be up for reelection. And I think there will be a lot of political calculation as to whether or not they can go as far as they did this year. And I think, actually, if you look at it from 30,000 feet, like probably a lot of stuff that passed this year because it was not an election year, and that they will be able to next year, you know, kind of distance themselves from those votes a little bit. I think those would have been very hard votes to take if they were facing election, you know,
and become
November.
More. I'm sorry, Jesse, and become more blue dogish, you know, as to whether it's conservative Democrats.
Yeah, well, yeah, certainly, or at least, you know, practical Democrats. You know, there was a tweet from Brad Hoyleman, who's a liberal senator from Manhattan, right after the end of session, that was he was like, well, wait till next year. We're even going to top what we did this year. I'm not totally sure that's true. I think next year will be a lot of fiscal stuff. I think it'll be a lot of just kind of like managing the books. I think it'll be a lot less kind of socially minded, because I think those votes are hard to take and hard to defend in an election year sometimes in those districts.
Jesse McKinley of the New York Times is our guest, and I want to ask you this, Jesse. Look, we all know that if the Democrats get to the next redistricting, they're going to keep the control of the state legislature and the Senate forever. But they're not there yet. I've often wondered why, and like in other states, as soon as they get into office, they don't hold it, you know, they just don't redistrict. That's always been a fascinating one. But they do risk messing it up, don't they?
Well, you know, the redistricting, I think, will come up next year. And I think you're right. I think that in large part, the Republicans were able to maintain power in the Senate because districts were drawn in such a way to favor them. I mean, the Supreme Court on Thursday obviously came down and said,
They can do whatever they want.
They can do whatever they want. Like, this is not a constitutional issue. And I think for Republicans who are seeking to hold control of New York State Senate districts, let alone the Congress, that is probably pretty good news. But of course, you know, Democrats have gerrymandered districts as well. But
to be fair, there are a lot more Democrats in New York State.
I mean, there are
than
so
there are Republicans.
A lot more, I think, maybe an understatement. There's 5.5 million Democrats and something like 2 million Republicans in the state of New York. It's really kind of an overwhelming advantage for the Democrats. But
it does show you the power of the gerrymander, that with 3 million less potential voters, they could still hold on by allocating voters into specific districts.
100%. And you know, you're looking, I mean, the thing that's fascinating about New York State, and has always, as a reporter who was working in California and then came to New York, but what was fascinating to me is there are wide swaths of New York State that are Republican and conservative and vote that way, you know? So there's nothing wrong with having those voices represented. I think the question has always been, you know, how much sway does New York City have over upstate issues? And how much does New York City, which is overwhelmingly Democrat and reflects that in the Senate, you know, how much say should they have over upstate issues? Because those are very different issues. I mean, you're talking about agricultural issues and land use issues and infrastructure issues and things that don't really occur to someone that's living on 86th Street.
Or 89th Street.
Yeah.
So the next question is, Cuomo is saying that this has been the most productive legislative session in history. So was it? And what were some of the things you'd point to that make a real difference?
Well, I think it would be pretty easy to look back at the press releases from previous sessions. And I think that phrase, most productive, best ever, you know, I think that phrase comes up pretty regularly with the Cuomo administration. I don't think his press office is shy about using superlatives. But I would say that in terms of a progressive wish list, this was a big year. You know, there were things like rent reform, which was critical for a broad swath of particularly New York City residents, but also people around the state. I think the climate thing is ambitious, but is certainly kind of putting a line in the sand in terms of what the state wants to do in terms of carbon emissions. Even things like the DREAM Act, which had been bottled up because of the Republican Senate for years and years, which gives, scholarships to undocumented immigrants who want to go to college to better themselves. I think those sorts of progressive wish list items were done this year. And they did really have they have something to stand on, particularly the legislature. I mean, if you talk to legislative leaders privately and or publicly, they will say, you know, a lot of the stuff we were working on for years and years and years, and it was either bottled up by the Republican Senate or not particularly embraced by the Cuomo camp. So they got a lot done, and I don't think they can certainly take their 6-month break and deserve it.
Now, Cuomo says this is the most progressive session, but he wishes that more progressive legislation was passed. This seems to me there's this wicked sort of thing going on between the state Senate Democrats and the governor, in which he is treating them much like he used to treat the Republicans. He can't get off of that.
Yeah, you know, I think there, once again, if you talk to political consultants on both sides of the aisle, I think that the general take on Andrew Cuomo is he doesn't play well with others. You know, it's that he spoils for a fight pretty much whenever he can. That is in his nature. He has said as much in interviews. You know, he's like, I like being aggressive. I like pushing. I like pulling. You know, he kumbaya does not come to him naturally. And, you know, an argument could be made that certainly he gets things done by that tactic. But the other argument could be made that it could be unpleasant for people to deal with. I think that it doesn't particularly, inure him to national Democrats who might be looking for national leaders. You know, I think the word on the street is that Cuomo runs, a very tight but very aggressive ship here in New York. But it certainly doesn't help him on a national stage.
So how much does the Cuomo name count? I mean, you know, you have this leftist tilt of the, in these elections and the rest of it, but Cuomo stands tall. Is it because his name is Cuomo?
I think political dynasties are political dynasties. I don't think there's any, there's no doubt that having the last name Kennedy has helped a number of candidates, whether or not they're related to the Kennedy family. And I think that the Cuomo name certainly carries a lot of weight. I'm not completely convinced that some people don't think they're still voting for Mario Cuomo when they vote for Andrew Cuomo. But he does certainly have a record of accomplishments at this point to stand on, regardless of his father's legacy. But certainly having his dad be governor didn't hurt.
Do you really think that Cuomo wanted recreational marijuana? He told me a long time ago he was opposed to it. Then things moved left. He moved left. Do you think it's double, triple, quadruple fake out that's going on here?
I would not be totally surprised. I mean, I think that if you look at the governor's approach towards marijuana, even in terms of its medical use, a couple of years ago when in 2014, I think it was, when they legalized medical use, advocates told me that the program itself was so restrictive, particularly considering other states had done this and other states had successfully had medical marijuana programs. The fact that, there was no smoking allowed, that it was only tinctures and ointments and things like that. They legalized it, but the program itself wasn't really workable as a result of all the dictums that had come down from Cuomo's office as to how it should operate. And you know him as well as I do. I mean, I think when he wants to get something done, he gets something done. And I never felt the weight or the passion or the pressure from the governor to get marijuana legalized this year. Like, it just never felt real to me. Like he really wanted to do this. I think he, gave lip service to it to an extent. And you can date this back to last year's primary campaign where Cynthia Nixon came out very strongly in favor of legalizing marijuana. And then he promptly said, "Oh yeah, I'm in favor of this too."
Oh, but yeah, I'm for that too.
Yeah, but it was never a top priority. And although he kept mentioning it, it never felt like he was really advocating for it. And I think if you talk to legislative people, that is confirmed.
So is what I'm hearing that you think that the Senate and the Assembly wanted it and that he might not have wanted it?
Well, I think that also,
was it disingenuous?
I don't know if it was disingenuous, but if you read those bills are complicated and there's a lot of ins and outs and changes in not only public health law, but in criminal statute and stuff like that. Like it's complicated stuff. So, but that being said, a lot can get done in Albany pretty quickly if they want it to get done. And I did not sense that Mr. Cuomo necessarily wanted it to get done that quickly.
Which is interesting. He says he didn't want to. Maybe it was important that we had to duke it out. But he said, if we put it in the budget, it'll pass right away. So that's a little different than how important it is and how many details there are.
Yeah. I mean, his argument there was like, well, you can stick it in the budget and they'll have to take a vote on like 400 different things, so they'll have a little bit of political cover to handle this. I think that's a little bit different than saying this is a complicated issue that really needs to be thought through.
Jesse McKinley, Andrew Cuomo went to Israel. How come? Is the Jewish vote that important in New York?
Well, he does this periodically. And, I was with him in 2017 when he went over there. And, these are symbolic missions, obviously. But, I don't think there's any great kind of trade deals being done. By the same token, New York City, I think, is the largest population of Jewish people in the United States or anywhere in the world outside of Israel. It is a important and vital constituency in the state and in the city. And I don't think there's anything wrong with showing unity. I think that he does this periodically, mainly to show that he is at one with the Jewish community. I think that this year is a little bit trickier because I think Netanyahu is in a little bit of a defensive posture. I think that certainly, he's been brought up on criminal charges in Israel and certainly he has been a staunch Trump supporter. And of course, that stands at odds with Cuomo's kind of testimonials that he hates President Trump. So I think politically it's a little bit trickier, but I think that it's for New York state governor to go to Israel is a worthy and admirable thing. I think they do this all the time, in large part because the population of Jewish people in New York is so strong and vital. So
De Blasio for president. And we watched the debate. He got up there. He got some good marks from Sun. The New York Post had people laughing on its front page about it. Is it a joke or what's behind it all?
Well, I think that De Blasio's presidential, I mean, keep in mind, he's term limited out. He's going to be looking for a job not too long from now. And I think that there is a certain political calculation probably for Bill de Blasio that if, he's probably not going to be elected president, but if he makes a credible showing, at least perhaps he could have a cabinet position, Department of Labor or something like that, if a Democrat is elected president. And I also think, what's interesting about presidential campaigns is it is surprising. You can catch fire pretty quickly in these sort of things. I mean, you look at Mayor Pete out of Indiana, like that's a guy that nobody had heard of, 6 months ago, who all of a sudden is on people's lips and is, being talked about as a potential vice presidential candidate or as a potential, someone that could once again end up in the cabinet or could be a candidate, 4 years, 8 years, 12 years from now. So there's no harm, I think, for politicians in running for president because they get a lot of free press and their name recognition goes up. And as a result, their political brand increases.
Let's talk a little bit about driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants. The county clerks, some of county clerks, of course, politically, it's healthy for them, are saying, we're going to sue. We're not going to do this. We saw that with gay marriage. Remember that?
Yep.
And people said they wouldn't do it. They had to do it. So what do you think?
Well, I think Mickey Kearns out of Erie County was the first guy to say he's not going to do this. Mickey is an interesting figure. He's technically a Democrat, although when he was in the assembly, he was persona non grata in that conference. Like they didn't. I don't think they even let him sit in on meetings because of his kind of independent streak. Inevitably these sorts of things do end up in a courtroom. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't speak to whether or not it's legal or not. But the underpinning of this is a political underpinning, right? We're talking about driver's licenses for undocumented people, which on its face, if you kind of separate the kind of inflammatory politics for it, is kind of a simple idea. It's like if I were to move to Canada and I wanted to get a driver's license and I could operate a motor vehicle, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. But here it always involves, immigration and it all involves illegal immigration. And it also involves this kind of antiquated and somewhat bizarre thing that you can use a driver's license to get on an airplane. You can use a driver's license to get on. It is basically the de facto governmental ID. That's where the rubber hits the road on this issue, because what happens is that Republicans particularly and conservatives say, look, you don't want to give this sort of kind of carte blanche to people that might have come here illegally, that are breaking the law. And that's where it really gets complicated. Although on its face, it's somewhat of a simple issue. Like, can you drive an automobile? Can you, ipso facto, you should have a driver's license. But because we use the driver's license for so many different things to get on, as a source of identification, that's where it really gets complicated.
Jesse McKinley, nothing drives people in New York State crazier than rent control laws. And we saw it. All of a sudden, people who didn't know where Albany was are showing up, banging on doors, screaming at legislators. Can you give us a little reprise as to what went on there?
Well, that was a major issue. And I think that, to harken back to what we were talking about before, like this was an opportunity where in previous years where you had a Republican Senate, more than likely these, you just would have had kind of a general kind of re-upping of rent control and things would have considered, continued as they had been. But this year, because there was an all-Democratic monopoly in Albany, you really had kind of like a radical rethinking of like getting rid of, you know, vacancy decontrol, which, you know, I will speak from personal experience. Like my older brother has had a, you know, a rent control department that, like, once they got into a certain level of rent, all of a sudden they could raise the rent as much as they want. And that was frustrating, right? Because, you know, a lot of people are working on a budget. A lot of people, you know, New York City is a very expensive place to live. And I think that those kind of minor grievances kind of eventually bubbled up and became this kind of progressive energy that when they had a chance to actually really look at rent and really look at how, you know, landlords are able to like jack the rent on people, this was the moment at which they were able to strike back and say...
Because the Republicans were... Jesse, I'm sorry for interrupting. Because the Republicans were out of power.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, and they had... They saw their moment and they really took their shot. And what was interesting about this is that, the legislature did this pretty much without the governor's consent. And he did... You know, the governor stepped back from negotiations and said, send me whatever bill you want. And sure enough, the legislature did. And they called his bluff. And then the governor was in a position of either, you know, vetoing something that I think millions of New York City residents were, which, by the way, is people that vote for him. He was either in the position of vetoing a bill that they probably would have liked or signing it. And at the end of the day, he signed it and he kind of did it with a shrug. I mean, the post-rent deal press conference, he was basically like, okay, fine, I'll do it. But he was not enthusiastic about it.
Well, he took their money.
Well, he certainly took REBNY, the Real Estate Board of New York. You know, he has certainly taken millions of dollars from real estate interests. And so I think he probably heard it. I think the lobbyists were probably on the phone saying, what happened here? And yet he was boxed in, you know, because he had said he would sign whatever they sent him.
Wow, so interesting. Okay, really quickly, Bob Freeman, a guy who everybody had only good words to say for years, as he represented when people wanted to go get something and the press wanted something, he said, no, you got to give it to them, to government. Now he's out. He's fired for basically sexual conduct. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I think what's interesting about that is that, you know, the Me Too movement, which I, you know, to pat the New York Times on the back a little bit, like, was really started by, you know, Jodi Kantor and Megan Twalley's stories of October 2017, which really blew the lid off, you know, Harvey Weinstein's behavior, which then blew the lid off so many other men's bad behavior. That continues to percolate. And I think that the young reporter who came forward and said, look, this guy was a creep to me, Bob Freeman, and treated me in like just really a slimy, terrible way. She should be celebrated for being incredibly courageous and like stepping forward in what's a tricky situation. You know, Bob Freeman, as the head of the Committee for Open Government, kind of had sway over... you know, not sway, but certainly like was kind of considered a mentor to a lot of people. And even after that story posted by I think it was Joe Spector at Gannett. And, you know, even after that story posted, I started to get emails in my inbox from other young reporters who said, look, this was not an anomaly. And Lauren Amias, who used to be up here in Albany and is now on the Daily News editorial board, wrote a very eloquent editorial right after the news broke that said, look, he did the same thing to me. So I think more and more what we're seeing is a reckoning with bad behavior. And, you know, with all of these things, daylight always helps, you know, and people coming forward and being transparent about this stuff always helps. And in the case of Bob Freeman, it's good riddance, you know.
That's all we have time for now. We thank Jesse McKinley of The New York Times. He's a great hero to so many of us. He really covers the Albany bureau chief of The New York Times. Jesse, once again, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.